From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. It's been an extraordinary day of public testimony on Capitol Hill. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's one-time lawyer and personal fixer, is testifying before the House Oversight Committee. In his opening statement, Mr. Cohen described President Trump this way.
He is a racist. He is a con man. And he is a cheat. He was a presidential candidate who knew that Roger Stone was talking with Julian Assange about a WikiLeaks drop on the Democratic National Committee emails.
Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
So the hearings have been tense. They've been occasionally testy. It's kind of gripping political theater, but are we learning anything new about President Trump?
I think we are. I think we're filling in a lot of the details. Cohen is also, this is the first chance that lawmakers or really anyone has had a chance to ask extended follow-up questions. For instance, there was a question based on some reports earlier on whether President Trump had directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress, as BuzzFeed initially reported. Cohen is testifying today that there was no direct statement, you should lie to Congress, but he said through his actions, through his inferring that his message, what he understood then candidate Donald Trump and then later President Trump to say was you should lie to Congress. Several other things like that. Cohen saying that he was in the room when he heard a conversation where Trump was told that WikiLeaks had damaging information about the DNC. He also talked about seeing Donald Trump Jr. come and talk to Donald Trump about what Cohen assumed was that infamous meeting in Trump Tower where Russian operatives said we have information about Hillary Clinton.
So a lot of the details getting filled in. And it really has been kind of a fascinating look into Mr. Trump's 2016 campaign for the White House, with Mr. Cohen saying, you know, he never thought he would win. That's why he kept pursuing the Trump Tower project.
Absolutely, saying that he viewed it as one big infomercial and that he saw a chance to continue making money. And that's why not only did Cohen and others in the Trump organization continue pursuing the deal as late as they did in the 2016 election, but he says that's why President Trump had no qualms lying about the fact that he had no business with Russia, no dealings with Russia, statements that you probably remember from the presidential debates and other times in 2016.
Republicans have aggressively portrayed Cohen as a fraud and a liar, as the real con man, someone who just can't be trusted. He lied to Congress and others before, they've noted repeatedly. Here's Ohio Republican Jim Jordan, the committee's ranking member, questioning Cohen.
When you made false statements to financial institutions concerning a home equity line of credit, taxi medallions in your Park Avenue apartment in 2013, 2014, and 2015, and you pled guilty to making those false statements to those banks. Was that all done to protect the president?
No, it was not.
Scott, seems like Republicans are really trying to get under Cohen's skin and their main line of attack. They're hammering away that, you know, you're a liar. Do you think it's working?
You know, I'm curious how this plays, because it's hard to paint somebody as a liar and a con and a fraud when he basically admitted to that in his opening testimony. I mean, Cohen has been pretty blunt about the fact he is on his way to federal prison because he lied to Congress. And he admitted that. He said he apologized for it. I think some of the questions that I'm curious if they stick is that, you know, if Donald Trump was all these things that you say, a racist, a con man, a fraud, as the opening statement said, why did you work for him for a decade? Mm. You know, that one thing that stuck out to me was a congressman asked Cohen, what is your source of income going forward? And Cohen said, I don't expect to have much income when I'm in a federal penitentiary.
Right. I mean, I'm curious, too, are there any Republicans that are sort of deviating from the line of attack that you're a liar, you're a liar?
Not as of yet. I mean, there's been several strains of you're a liar, going from Cohen's own personal dealings, his own personal loans, embarrassing things about himself and his past, and also things that he did for President Trump. I mean, I think that the tape that we just heard gets to the heart of it, saying, you know, Michael Cohen, you're here saying you did all this stuff on behalf of President Trump and the Trump Organization, but you also lied and committed shady business practice to further your own self-gain. This was not just working for Donald Trump. This was about you.
Trump tweeted from Vietnam overnight about how Cohen, quote, did bad things unrelated to Trump. He is lying in order to reduce his prison time, end quote. In the last 30 seconds here, I mean, has Cohen implicated Trump in any actual crimes today? Anything we didn't know about?
Well, he produced checks as evidence. This is something we knew about already, but he has presented checks that he was paid by the Trump Organization with the blessing from Donald Trump. He says as part of that agreement where Cohen paid women in order for them not to go public about alleged affairs with Donald Trump in 2015 and 2016. So we're seeing the documents that back up some of the court filings we've seen.
Scott Detrow, NPR's congressional correspondent. Scott, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
And as we just heard, President Trump is paying attention to the Cohen fireworks from Hanoi, Vietnam, where he and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are embarking on a second round of high-stakes denuclearization talks. The summit began on an upbeat note, with the president saying that their first historic meeting last June in Singapore was a success.
We made a lot of progress, and I think the biggest progress was our relationship is really a good one.
But politics at home clearly still on the president's mind. Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe, traveling with the president in Vietnam. Aisha, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we mentioned the president's tweet about Michael Cohen, who is making pretty extraordinary claims against the president on Capitol Hill today. How much is this clouding an otherwise monumental day in Vietnam?
I think you can't understate the fact that this is overshadowing what normally would be the biggest news out there, that you have another meeting between the president of the United States and the head of North Korea. The first summit was obviously historic. And so for them to be meeting again and discussing the topic of denuclearization of North Korea, that's a big deal. But this Michael Cohen testimony is going to be taking up a lot of airspace, a lot of headlines, and I'm sure President Trump will be paying attention to that. He doesn't like to be overshadowed.
Some people saying he might actually be distracted during these negotiations, depending on how the day unfolds. The two leaders, Kim and Trump, kicked this summit off with a brief meeting together and then a dinner, which you were actually one of the few reporters who was allowed to attend that meal. What did you see?
Well, it was them sitting at a round table. It was President Trump, and he was joined by two officials, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney. And then Kim was able to have two North Korean officials with him. And President Trump seemed to be in a good mood. He was kind of joking with the photographers and saying, wouldn't you like to know what we were talking about in our one-on-one? So he seemed to be in a kind of upbeat mood when it came to the dinner.
He was kind of showing off his personal rapport with Kim, who is, by the way, a dictator and has been accused of serious human rights violations. What about that? Because the president has made a big deal of his personal relationship with Kim. Does it appear genuine from what you've seen as the two men have interacted, or is it more of a negotiating tactic?
It's really something that I don't know that you can know from afar. President Trump definitely has praised Kim, and he praised him again today, calling him a leader. And he talked about how great his relationship is with him. Now, President Trump often will make politics very personal. And so that seems to be the way he kind of frames these interactions, through this idea of friendship or being close or we get each other. And so that's kind of the way he seems to view diplomacy.
And the formal negotiations will begin tomorrow. Lay out what each side, what their goals are, what they hope to accomplish when this really gets going.
So President Trump and the White House, they've made clear, it does seem like they do want some concrete steps. I think that ultimately it will not be acceptable to come out of this meeting once again with kind of vague promises. Like, they need to show that North Korea is actually moving towards a denuclearization and maybe perhaps even allowing inspectors in. That would be a big deal. Also, possibly providing some type of inventory. I don't think anyone expects them to give a full inventory of what weapons they have, but something. That's what the White House and that's what the administration wants. North Korea wants some easing of the sanctions. And that is where there is a disconnect, because the White House is saying that they're going to stand firm. And until there's real denuclearization, they're not going to roll back the sanctions. But there may be some wiggle room where they may allow some economic projects to go forward if North Korea is willing to take certain steps. So you may have some compromise there. But it seems like they want to keep the force of the sanctions on, or the main thrust of them. They want to keep them on and not lift them right now.
All right. And briefly, you're there in Hanoi. What is it like? Because clearly Vietnam is itself playing a role in these negotiations.
Yeah, and President Trump talked continually today about saying how Vietnam could be a model for North Korea, because it is growing and thriving, and you do see the buildings going up. And people did seem to, at least, I don't know whether they're happy about the visit, but they seemed fascinated. And, you know, people were lining the streets, kind of looking at the motorcades and seeing what was going on. And so this does seem to be a big deal for Vietnam to be hosting this summit.
That's Ayesha Roscoe, NPR White House correspondent, traveling with the president in Hanoi. Ayesha, thanks for staying up late to speak with us.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
The Rolling Stones hit the road again in April, the band's first North American tour since 2015. The first show is April 20th in Miami. They'll wrap up the tour in Chicago on June 21st. This year marks the 50th anniversary of a notorious Stones tour. They trekked across America in the fall of 1969. That 69 tour ended on a chilly December night in Altamont in Northern California. The free music festival, with scores of other bands, including the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and Santana, quickly descended into chaos. A young concertgoer was stabbed to death in front of the stage as the Stones played. Some have long pointed to Altamont as a symbolic end of 1960s idealism. Joel Selvin tells the story in Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hell's Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day. We spoke in 2016.
Joel, set the scene for us. The Stones in 69, you know, were huge. They had a new guitarist in Mick Taylor. The band was really intrigued by the Summer of Love psychedelia of the San Francisco sound. It's almost as if Mick Jagger wanted his own sort of version of Woodstock on the West Coast. Is that correct?
I think so. I think the Stones originally scheduled that tour out of sort of a financial emergency. They were broke and they couldn't get the money that they were owed out of their manager. And when they arrived here, they discovered the rock scene was quite significantly different than the 3 years before when they last played in the United States. And I think they were quite surprised by how famous, how enormous the whole rock scene had come and what their position was. Hmm. And over the course of the tour, as they began to discover this, they began to see a vision of a bigger, brighter future. And the last dates in New York were filmed for a movie that hadn't been planned until the day before. Hmm. But they didn't have an end to the movie. They just had the New York. The free concert had been in the works. It was an idea that had been promoted to Keith Richards by the Grateful Dead manager, Rock Scully, and I think in a somewhat sort of whimsical fashion. Hmm. But it had been taken seriously in the Stones camp, and Rock, he picked it up and ran with it. And at that point, I think that the vision of this free concert in this Woodstock-esque setting was just too seductive as an ending to this movie.
So the Stones were just beginning to understand the depth of their own fame and popularity. And you make clear that one of the Grateful Dead's managers, Rock Scully, was really behind the idea to let the Hell's Angels provide security for the free concert. But the Stones went along with it. It proved to be a fatal mistake.
The Hell's Angels were well known to the Grateful Dead. One of the Hell's Angels, for instance, was the LSD distributor for Owsley, the manufacturer of all the Grateful Dead's LSD and their audio expert. The original plans called for the concert to be held in Golden Gate Park, which would put the San Francisco chapter of Hell's Angels squarely in charge. When it moved out of San Francisco after the Rolling Stones tried to get permits out of the mayor's office, Rock Scully never expected to do it that way. His plan was to have a Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane concert and bring the Stones in as a surprise special guest. But when it moved out of San Francisco, then there was no jurisdiction for the Hell's Angels, and it was a free-for-all. Don't think that that kind of subtle politics of the Hell's Angels that was totally lost on the Rolling Stones, who had no idea who the California Hell's Angels were. Mm-hmm. They'd had a free concert in Hyde Park, and British Hell's Angels had attended, and been given some role backstage. But these guys had clean leather jackets. They drew their colors on with chalk, and they rode mopeds. They were not
the Hells Angels, right? And the first thing that happens to Mick Jagger when he gets to the concert site and gets off the helicopter, somebody cold cocks him in the face.
They hit Mick. Somebody hit him.
Yeah, some kid just comes up and just says, you know, hate you, Mick Jagger, and punches him. The whole day was just filled with random acts of violence. It was just a terrible, bad happenstance from the dawn when the gates crashed and the crowd flooded in. Even the night before, which was some kind of like medieval bacchanal in the woods with, you know, thousands of stoned and drunk people wandering around in the dark, setting fires to barns and fences.
And the violence just escalates during the day, culminating in the Stones show. Set the stage here. Hell's Angels are starting to beat people with pool cues and brandishing weapons.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to point out in the book was the nature of the psychedelic drugs at that time. In 1967, the Summer of Love, the people who made LSD were missionaries. They were zealots, and the chemists took great lengths to make sure that the compounds were stable. 2 years later, the manufacturer just devolved, and there was a lot of really poisonous LSD out there. I talked to the doctors that ran the bummer tent, the psychiatrists, and they were appalled at what they were seeing. And the Hells Angels were all on drugs, those drugs too. There are a few guys that were put in front of a stage, 300,000 people from a mile away pressing down on the stage was 4 feet high. And right during the Santana set, the opening set of the day, the pool cues came out and people in the audience started getting beaten.
And it's all on film in the famous documentary about the Stones, Gimme Shelter. The Stones are playing, and the Angels just keep beating people up, and both Mick Jagger and Keith Richards plead with the Angels to stop.
Who's fighting what for? Who's fighting and what for? Why are we fighting? Why are we fighting? We don't want to fight. Come on. Look, Cat. If he doesn't stop it, man. Listen, either those cats call it, man, or we don't play.
There's a lot of blame to go around for Altamont, but you seem to put a lot of it in the book on Mick Jagger and his ego. You write, Jagger made the fatal error of believing his own hype. He bought into the myth of Woodstock and believed that he could do it better.
There's just so much innocence, and in the innocence, an arrogance. Nobody really knew what they were doing. They just assumed it could be done. And Jagger was dismissive of things that were brought up in planning sessions like sanitation and food and water. Oh, those are practical realities. We can deal with those later.
Right.
So I don't think they were really very conscious of this. I think they lived in a bubble and just felt they were the Rolling Stones. And, of course, this would just work out and be fine.
Well, you seem to imply, too, that they needed an ending for their movie, and boy, did they get it.
More than they planned on.
Yeah.
But the movie, of course, is embedded in all the story. They moved the concert at the last minute because of the movie and their unwillingness to negotiate any piece of the movie rights with the owners of Sears Point Raceway, where after the Golden Gate Park site had collapsed, they were moving this. And that place had parking for 100,000 cars and infrastructure. It had a site on the hill where the stage would be elevated above the crowd. It was much more suitable than some dumpy track in the middle of nowhere with no toilets and no water. And that's never part in the movie. The movie doesn't make it clear. There's scenes in the movie where they're negotiating with sheriffs and stuff, but it's not made clear exactly what's going on. What's going on is the Stones are trying to save their money, and they don't care who they do business with as long as they keep 100% of the revenues from this movie.
You raised some questions in the book, too, of where were the police? They still had a responsibility here. The Hells Angels had control of the stage and the perimeter, and the police were largely absent until things got really out of control.
Oh, the police didn't show up until after there was a murder. There were no arrests made. They just sat there and watched it. The vehicular manslaughter case, which rarely gets mentioned, they had the suspect in custody, and he got away.
Joel, there's a popular idea that Altamont marked the end of 60s idealism. Is that accurate, or was this just a really dark day? What changed after Altamont?
I'm not sure what changed after Altamont. It certainly wasn't the end of the movement. It wasn't the end of idealism. It wasn't the end of even free concerts in the park. It left its mark on the people that were involved in it. I don't think the Stones or the Grateful Dead or even the Jefferson Airplane were ever the same again.
Neither were the Hells Angels, who kind of already seen as a public enemy, certainly were looked down on even also, more after Altamont.
Also true. It was really the beginning of the end for the Hells Angels.
Joel, for all the darkness and violence and ugliness of that day, the Stones played really well, yeah?
I heard a 16-track mix done by Bob Matthews, who was the engineer for the Grateful Dead, recorded that day. And you wouldn't believe how good the Stones sound. Charlie Watts on drums, Bill Wyman on bass have everything locked down. And Mick Taylor and Keith Richards' guitars are just like gears turning together. And Jagger singing like he really means it. None of that kind of caricature vocals that he sometimes lapses into. Very committed, very convincing.
The Hells Angels ruined a great concert.
The fear that was coursing through those guys, the adrenaline, obviously played such a role, and they just went and buried themselves in the music. That's what musicians do.
Joel Selvin's book is Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
We've been hearing blistering criticism today, along with a host of allegations against President Donald Trump from his former lawyer and personal fixer, Michael Cohen.
I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience. I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Cohen is testifying in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, and Cohen today said he had no direct evidence that the president colluded with Russia. He said Trump did know about hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee before they were released in the run-up to the 2016 election. Here's Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who had some of her emails leaked, questioning Cohen.
Moving on to a little later in 2016, a major WikiLeaks dump happens hours after the Access Hollywood tape is released. Do you believe or are you aware of Mr. Trump coordinating or signaling for this email dump?
I am unaware of that. I actually was not even in the country at the time of the Billy Bush tape. I was in London visiting my daughter.
Knowing how Mr. Trump operates with his winning at all costs mentality, do you believe that he would cooperate or collude with a foreign power to win the presidency? Is he capable of that?
It calls on so much speculation, ma'am. It would be unfair for me to.
I understand, but you have a tremendous amount of experience.
Mr. Trump is all about winning, and he will do what is necessary within reach to win.
And in your opinion and experience, would he have the potential to cooperate or collude with a foreign power to win the presidency at all costs?
Yes.
Republicans have repeatedly hammered at Michael Cohen's credibility. He has pleaded guilty to lying to Congress and a host of other crimes. Here's Republican Congressman Jim Jordan.
This might be the first time someone convicted of lying to Congress has appeared again so quickly in front of Congress. Certainly, it's the first time a convicted perjurer has been brought back to be a star witness in a hearing. And there's a reason this is the first, because no other committee would do it. Think about this. With Mr. Cohen here, this committee, we got lots of lawyers on this committee. This committee is actually encouraging a witness to violate attorney-client privilege. Mr. Chairman, when we legitimize dishonesty, we delegitimize this institution.
For his part, Cohen also said today that Donald Trump saw his run for office as one big marketing and business venture, as simply a way to further himself.
He had no desire or intention to lead this nation, only to market himself and to build his wealth and power. Mr. Trump would often say, this campaign was going to be the greatest infomercial in political history.
Cohen is testifying before he heads to prison to serve his 3-year term this spring. A recent study from the U.S. Census Bureau shows rural counties have significantly less access to high-speed internet than other regions. That disparity is even greater in rural areas with high rates of poverty. This creates some big problems for economic development. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All has our story.
And they're all custom Bacons today. Have several different machines, but that's probably the one that's used the most right there, that Bacon slicer.
Janice Thomas is walking through a giant meat cooler at Swiss Meat and Sausage in the small unincorporated village of Swiss in central Missouri. Workers are cutting bacon for a special order. Swiss Meat and Sausage is celebrating its 50th year in business, and Thomas says it's been very successful. But they need to grow, and that means more business online from far-flung customers.
Well, I think that's the one area where we need to expand. I mean, if there's one place that has some room, that's what we're hoping to expand in the future, is with our online ordering.
But that's where the problem comes in. Swiss has minimal internet access. It's not high speed, and it's unreliable.
When it goes down, we can't get the orders, so it relies on that 100%.
Thomas says they invested in a satellite internet backup, but it's expensive and not reliable. It's a common problem for businesses that are in rural areas or looking to locate there. The lack of broadband service and no single unified effort to resolve the problem makes economic development much more difficult for regions that need to attract jobs. The struggles go well beyond traditional rural economic sectors like agriculture. Brewer Science is a microchip manufacturer based in Rolla, Missouri. They built a plant in the nearby small town of Vichy 5 years ago. Rob Chin is the company's network administrator. He says the lack of good internet access was a major issue.
It did force us to redesign how some of our manufacturing systems worked to tolerate internet outages. We also added a backup connection from a wireless ISP, which is just the bare minimum we need to continue production.
Chin says if it weren't for the local company owner being committed to locating in a rural area, Brewer Science would have passed over Vichy for a location with more reliable internet access. Tim Arbeiter says the struggles of those two companies are playing out in rural communities across the plains and Midwest. He's the director of broadband development for the Missouri Department of Economic Development. Arbeiter says businesses looking to expand or locate in a rural area start with a simple question.
Do I have the basic infrastructure needed to help me be successful in my respective business? And basic infrastructure now includes broadband, now includes high-speed internet. It is the utility of today.
While rural broadband issues are known and increasingly well-documented, the solutions are not as clear. Marshall Stewart leads the University of Missouri Extension and has adopted rural broadband as a pet project. He says there is a historical example, the Rural Electrification Project during the New Deal.
When it did, then it began to allow people to do commerce better. It allowed them to move product from the farm to the city. And I think what's happening in today's terminology is another iteration of that. Broadband today is what rural electrification was nearly 100 years ago.
But Stewart says the big difference is that rural electrification was a federally funded program.
the idea that there's going to be a sweeping federal effort to just fund broadband internet for the country, that's probably not going to happen wholesale.
Instead, he says, the solutions will be a combination of improved technology that will make it easier and cheaper to get broadband to rural areas, as well as targeted state and federal grant programs. The USDA announced in December it's offering $600 million in grants and low-interest loans to help expand broadband in rural areas. But businesses will rely upon internet service providers, rural co-ops, and local governments to apply for and get that federal money. For Here and Now, I'm Jonathan Aull.
To Britain now, and the latest on Brexit. Prime Minister Theresa May insisted today that the UK will leave the European Union on schedule next month, even though she bowed to pressure from her own Conservative Party yesterday and said Parliament would have a chance to delay the March 29th departure if lawmakers don't approve her Brexit deal. Let's bring in BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. And Rob, we come to you today for clarity, as we always do on this story. How can the Prime Minister insist that the UK will leave the EU on schedule a day after she gave Parliament the chance to postpone it?
I think for this reason, Peter, that she is hoping that now that she has laid out the possibility of delay, that will put pressure on those in her party who don't like her deal to say, oh, well, it's better than nothing, and it's certainly better than not leaving the EU as far as they're concerned.
Well, before anything happens, she has to get that deal, which failed miserably in Parliament last month, renegotiated with Europe. How's that going?
I think it's not going spectacularly well. It was always going to be tricky because if you think about it, if you were the European Union and you looked over the water towards the UK, would you see a country that was massively united, absolutely sure of what it wanted? Hmm. Or would you see a country at each other's throats, its politicians divided? You would, of course, see the latter. So I don't think the EU is minded to offer very much. But in a funny sort of way, Peter, I think that's not really the issue. I think the issue more at this point is, are those who are very enthusiastic about Brexit on the right of British politics, are they looking for a ladder to climb down now that they're facing this prospect of a possible delay to Brexit? And I guess, you know, we'll find out in the coming few days.
Theresa May was, some people were claiming, using this end of March deadline as leverage, almost playing out the clock so that once it got there, Parliament would have no choice. They would either crash out or just approve her deal because that would be a better option. Isn't she losing some of her leverage because of this?
It's a very good question. I don't think so. I mean, it's really important to remember, Theresa May, what is it she wants? I mean, she herself describes herself as this amazingly stubborn woman. And she has decided that her deal is the only way, the deal that she agreed with the EU and which she's working on a little bit, is really the only way of honouring that referendum of goodness almost 3 years ago. She's absolutely convinced herself of that, and I don't think that has changed at all. So then we come on to the issue of tactics, and I don't think her tactics have really changed very much either. I think she's hoping that MPs will either just be so desperate to do something about Brexit that they will sign up to her deal either now or sometime during a short extension. In other words, her idea is still the same one. My deal, my deal, my deal, and hope that eventually MPs will be panicked into supporting it, whether before the current deadline or any new deadline after an extension.
Okay, let's talk about some of the opposition. Here's a little montage of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn in the House of Commons today, and then I want to get your response.
Does the Prime Minister blame her shambolic Brexit?
Shambolic handling of Brexit!
Okay, so Rob, we Americans had to go to the dictionary for this to figure out what Corbyn means here by shambolic. It is a very British term, so I'm going to leave it to you to do the translating and put what he means into context.
As you can probably guess, shambolic is not massively complimentary. I guess I'm trying to think of an Americanism, having lived for so long in the United States. Basically what it means is an utter mess. I mean, it's hard not to look at what's happened in Brexit, the handling of the Brexit process, and not conclude, to use that very British word, that it's a bit of a shambles. So that's what he meant, that the handling has been chaotic.
Isn't it kind of rich, though, for Jeremy Corbyn to use that word? Because you might use it to describe the way he's led his party through these negotiations. This week he made a 180 and said that he would support a second referendum, which could overturn Brexit, and that happened after nine members of his party defected.
Well, you would, and he would certainly struggle against that charge. I mean, I guess his defence would be, look, hang on a minute, we're in the opposition, right? We're not in the government, so we're allowed to do this kind of thing. But I think to step back from it, Peter, and to make all of this a bit more accessible to everybody listening, that the thing about Brexit is that essentially, nearly three years on from the referendum, the kind of root of Britain's problem is that still, after all this time, Britain's politicians, whether they're Labour, whether they're Conservative, they still can't agree on what to do about the result of the referendum. I mean, it's that sort of simple, but also that profound. And I don't think anyone should be surprised about that. If you think about it, Britain's membership of the European Union has been absolutely at the sort of core plank of its economic policy, trade policy, security policy, foreign policy. It was always going to be incredibly difficult disentangling ourselves. And I think the criticism that could be made of Mr. Corbyn, Theresa May and all of the British politicians is that they might perhaps have levelled a bit more with the British people that this was always going to be tricky.
That's the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to Here and Now. A couple of items now from pro basketball. Africa will soon have its own pro basketball league. In a collaboration between the International Basketball Federation and the NBA, a league of 12 teams from across Africa will begin playing next year. It's unclear which existing teams will be in the league, but teams from Egypt, Angola, Kenya, Morocco, Nigeria, Rwanda, Senegal, South Africa, and Tunisia are expected to take part in a tournament to qualify for a spot. No country will be able to have more than two teams in the league. And former L.A. Lakers star Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is auctioning off four of his NBA championship rings and other items from his life in basketball. He wrote on his website that much of the money raised would go to his Skyhook Foundation, a charity that helps kids learn about science, technology, engineering, and math during summer camps. The four rings are from his championships while with the Lakers. Abdul-Jabbar wrote on his website, "Instead of gazing at the sparkle of jewels or gold plating celebrating something I did a long time ago, I'd rather look into the delighted face of a child holding their first caterpillar and think about what I might be doing for their future." The bidding on those items ends Saturday. Well, the sport of disc golf may not be as lucrative as pro basketball, but disc golf is booming, with the number of courses nationwide tripling over the past decade. One of the longest courses in the world is scheduled to open this spring near Pittsburgh. Amy Sisk from member station WESA has our story.
A small tractor with a shovel on its front end scoops up chunks of sandstone to cart across the hilly terrain at North Foundry Park in western Pennsylvania.
These are all, like, what would you call them, odds and ends?
Horse designer J. Gary Dropshow says the rock is left over from a project at a nearby quarry. The pieces will make up a retaining wall on a hilly section of the park.
We've been puzzling together some of these structures to landscape parts of the course.
When it's finished, players will end up walking 4 miles to play all 18 holes.
Yeah, it's a workout.
Disc golf is sort of like regular golf, but instead of whacking a ball with a club, players take a few quick steps across a tee to build momentum as they throw a disc. Think frisbee, but smaller and heavier. Participants have to avoid trees as they try to get the disc to land in a metal basket 150 to 900 feet away. A round is generally free, though a disc costs about $15. More people are taking part as new courses open up and they realize it's a fun and healthy way to spend a few hours outside.
We see tons of deer running through here. We've seen hawks. We've seen turkey.
Pittsburgh area disc golfers consider Dropshow a legend. He's played for decades, designed multiple courses, and he's even in the Sports Hall of Fame in Appling, Georgia. He's seen the game change a lot since Pittsburgh's first course went in at Schenley Park in 1988. Discs didn't fly as far in those days, and players weren't so skilled.
The courses are trying to keep up. We are trying to stay ahead of them, but I'm predicting that the top players will come here and they'll probably shoot 10 under par. Even though this course is way bigger and longer than anything else we've done, they're just that good.
I hop in a cart with Dropshow's partner on the project, Doug Cloutier. We go up a really steep climb that forces players to shoot uphill.
I calculated one time, I think it's a 25% slope.
We drive past the peak to hole 17 and walk toward the basket. It's elevated, so it's tricky to sink a putt. Cloutier doesn't want to miss and have his disc barrel down a drop-off on the other side.
Oh, no.
And it's down the hill.
Oh, no.
There it rolls.
That's what we refer to as a death putt.
The disc golf community here hopes a tough new course like this will attract major tournaments. They got a taste for the top level of play in 2015 when the World Championships took place at other courses nearby.
The excitement levels when the Worlds came was through the roof.
Lori Merriman chairs the nonprofit Pittsburgh Flying Disc.
We've had so many spectators come through just to see these top pros. Some of the spectators have never seen disc golf before, but, you know, they see this event, let's go check it out. And then we had other just beginner players who came out to just see what a pro looks like on the course.
Local officials say tourism is one benefit of creating a course. Pete Geis is the Parks and Recreation Director for Cranberry Township, where the course is located.
There are some aspects to this where it can definitely bring, you know, pretty significant money to our community. The direct impact for us, though, is just more people using our parks, you know, getting people outside, getting people on the trails.
He hopes to see that change late this spring, when construction wraps up and people can try their hand shooting for a basket.
Nice.
For Here and Now, I'm Amy Sisk in Pittsburgh.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.